I have used a lot of commerce platforms in the past. By far, the most robust is Shopify. No matter how complex your business needs and no matter how large your business grows, Shopify can handle it. And they do handle it for brands like Rothy's, Ruggable, Allbirds, Knox, Magnolia, Brooklinen, Glossier, and Cotton, to name a few. You may already use another e-commerce platform and you may be super unhappy with it, but you've already put a lot of work into it and migrating to Shopify could seem impossible. But I'm here to tell you that it is quite easy. When I migrated to Shopify back in 2022, their apps and tools meant I just had to make a few clicks and everything was ported over as if by magic. Shopify also lets you design your storefront however you like, which from personal experience I know isn't the case for many other commerce platforms out there. All these features and all this control can result in more sales more often. So stop leaving sales on the table. Switch your business to Shopify today and discover why millions trust Shopify as their all-in-one commerce platform to build, grow, and run their businesses. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial at shopify.com/practical, all lowercase. That's 1 month for just $1 at shopify.com/practical. shopify.com/practical. Hey there, Precopton. Today, we've got just a great episode. And I'm going to do some, I don't know what we call this, post-mortem introduction recording to talk about what this episode is and why I've done it and how fortunate I am to have such an illustrious guest on the show. If you are unfamiliar with A.A. Long, there's a link in the show notes to his vast Wikipedia page. When it comes to minds within Stoicism, minds which are still alive, Tony Long is without peer, really. If it were not for Tony, no one who has a career of any sort, from people like Ryan Holiday and myself, to people like Chris Fisher and the College of Stoic Philosophers, to people like William Stevens, who co-hosts this episode with me, and Massimo Pigliucci. None of those people would have the careers they have without the work that this man did. Now, he's very humble about that fact, and we thank him many times throughout the recording for that being the case, and he is, again, very humble about it. And he probably feels that way, as you'll hear, because he didn't go after Stoicism with the intention of resurrecting it. He just went after it with an academic interest in studying something that wasn't very popular or being studied to, in a way, set himself apart from what his peers were working on. He had no grand ambitions, so to speak. But again, without him, none of the rest of us would really be here, career-wise, anyway. So every Stoic influencer you follow, regardless of whether they are modern Stoics or traditional Stoics or popularizers or, like me, communicators of Stoicism, they wouldn't be here without this guy. Now, you might imagine that someone who I'm giving this much pre-recording attention to, let's say, that I'm building up in this way, is going to really over-deliver in regards to just how much he knows and how valuable this discussion is going to be, I think. And it is important to know that if you've never gotten the opportunity to sit down with someone who is as, and I hope this doesn't come across poorly, but as old as Tony is, and as well studied, and who has had such a long career in one focus, the classics in Tony's case, that the amount of knowledge they have is cranked up so high to those of us who are not there yet, that there are some references and words that may come up in this conversation that you won't know. And I had to walk a very, I think, somewhat difficult tightrope of not wanting to pull Tony back to discussions of rudimentary things in philosophy or Stoicism, and also making sure it didn't go too deep. I hope I did okay on finding that balance, but I'm going to need to encourage you to, if you hear things that are a bit over your head, if you're newer to Stoicism, that you're just going to need to write that word down and go look it up. Because you don't have someone like Tony onto the show to talk the basics. In this episode, we talk about free will, We talk about whether virtue ethics even exists anymore in contemporary times, or if it's all just reboot and re-envisioning of classical virtue ethics. We talk about the cataleptic as the criterion of truth in Stoicism and why that was so controversial in the formation of Zeno's philosophy of Stoicism. And in between the questions that I meticulously crafted in this interview, you're going to get little bits and pieces of a broader classical world that are probably going to pique your interest. You're going to hear names you haven't heard before, terms you haven't heard before, all kinds of things you haven't heard before that are not directly related to the conversation that I set out to have, but will absolutely pique your interest in learning more. And so along the same lines as the conversation I had with Anya Leonard about classics in general and her interest in an exploration of it, this episode is going to teach you a lot about Stoicism, but it's also going to encourage you to go out and learn more about more than just Stoicism. So I hope you enjoy it. At the end of this, there will be an opportunity for patrons to hear an additional 15 minutes where I ask some additional questions of Tony, and he's very kind to spend even longer with myself and Will, specifically for patrons of this podcast. So if you are a patron, please be sure to check the Patreon feed for that special extra. And with that, I will stop talking and get right into my conversation with William O. Stevens and A.A. Long. Hi, William. How are you?
Hello, Tanner.
We're joined by, not to take anything away from you, William, but probably the most prestigious guest we've ever had on this show.
Indeed.
Who's that? Who's that next to you?
That is the great Anthony Long, the magnificent Tony Long.
One of the great things about this format, Tony, because it's all recorded for release later, is that I get to build a really great intro of who you are after the fact, and I don't have to embarrass you with a really long-winded intro. Instead, I get to ask you to introduce yourself to those who are listening and who, on the off chance they don't already know who you are, to explain a little bit about who you are.
Thank you very much, Tanner, for inviting me. And it's very nice to see my old friend Bill, William, here. We encountered each other about 30 years ago in a seminar in Berkeley on Epictetus. So I'm a retired professor of classics and philosophy at Berkeley, where I've taught for 40 years. Before that, I was a professor in England. And I mentioned that partly because my teacher was a wonderful scholar called David Furley, was the person who introduced me to Stoicism in a very simple way. People often ask, how do you come to do these particular topics? And I'd been working on Sophocles, the Greek tragedian, and didn't know quite what to work on next. And this is way back in the 1960-something. And he said, I think Stoicism is the most neglected field in ancient philosophy. He himself had been an expert on Epicureanism, and of course, everybody was working away on Plato and Aristotle, but Stoicism was an absolutely dead duck in England at the time. And the idea that it could become a kind of, you know, a fashionable place for people to go to advice would have been laughed to scorn in England that time. Stoicism? You know, what the heck's that? You know, people like Matthew Arnold were interested in Stoicism, but we're modern. And so the transformation that has happened during my lifetime since I began working on it is enormous. And I should just explain that what got me into it wasn't its, you know, value, which I'm sure is very great for people as a sort of life coach. It was a purely intellectual interest. I sort of found the ideas of Stoicism, many of which I didn't agree with, but absolutely fascinating. And the ambition of philosophy to come up with a comprehensive world picture in which we could somehow situate ourselves and at the same time find some help in living a decent life, that was really what eventually grabbed me very much. So since then, I've worked on other things besides Stoicism, but I somehow keep going back to it. And so here we are, and I'm very happy to have this conversation today.
Well, you're not happier than I am to have you on the show because you are what is referred to in the biz as a tough get. it's not easy to get you to come on podcasts and talk to people. So I feel very honored in that regard, and I want to extend a sincere thank you to you for taking the time. I think I piqued your interest initially because I wrote to you about a conversation about free will that myself and William and also that Christopher Gill have had in the past. And William here suggested that you would be someone who would have maybe a lot to say about that. Can I ask, do you remember the questions that I asked in the email that I sent to you? Are you prepared to talk a little bit about free will in ancient Stoicism today?
Well, I'm certainly prepared to talk about notions of Stoicism and agency and determinism. Free will is a little bit of a controversial notion, one and even controversial, I think, to apply to Stoicism, but we can come to clarify it.
So I am nowhere near as eloquent as either one of you. So I have written this first question down, and you're going to have to forgive me for it being so long. I just wanted to make sure that I got it right in asking it, because it's been something that I've wrangled with in my own personal Stoic practice, and I've also wrangled with it publicly with people who enjoy the show or have interacted with my written content elsewhere. So I will just ask it. Free will in contemporary times means something like the ability for us to choose, and in particular to choose our actions and decisions. I can, for example, choose to drive to the store or choose to call my father on the phone. I can will things to happen. But that last part, willing things to be done, is something the Stoics would not have thought of as being possible. To the Stoics, the only things we can will are some of our emotions, our thoughts, or our attitudes. But somewhere between the contemporary understanding of will and the ancient Stoic understanding of will, if there was one, many contemporary Stoics seem to arrive at the conclusion that in Stoicism, free will doesn't exist at all. Whereas the conclusion that I have arrived at, and what I'm hopeful for you to talk me through, Tony, is that modern thinkers simply expanded the domain of will to include will over externals, while the ancient Stoics would have limited the domain of will completely to the hegemonicon or the rational faculty. So my contention is that free will does exist within Stoic philosophy, just sans the modern expansion of the domain. Do you agree with that? And if not, or if so, what are your thoughts on free will being compatible with Stoicism?
Taking it up from the way you put it, you said that there's a tendency to think of the only domain of freedom in Stoicism is freedom to deal with one's emotions. But let's start from that. What are emotions in Stoicism? Emotions are our states of mind, to which we have given our assent because, let us say, there's an ice cream there that looks very attractive. That's the external impression. And I decide whether or not I wish to assent to that impression. And if I do assent to that impression, and because it's the kind of impression of something that could stimulate action, i.e. to go and get the ice cream and eat it, I assent to it. That, in turn, according to Stoic psychology and physiology, will cause me to move my body towards the ice cream and eat it. So this notion that we're not in charge at all of what happens in the world doesn't seem correct. I mean, we move our bodies, and our bodies have external consequences. So I'm puzzled a bit by why people would think that action is somehow not possible, you know, for a Stoic, a choice of action.
So that's great, and I'm gonna turn things over to William as soon as I answer that question, because I want to explain why I think that's the case, and I want you to tell me why it's wrong, and I want William to help you tell me why it's wrong. The reason I think it is that, as far as I understand Stoic fatalism and determinism, after you make a choice in the domain of the mind, let's say to go and eat that ice cream, while you have made the decision to move, fate determines whether or not you are capable of moving your body, or whether something might not happen between your assenting to the choice to reach for that ice cream and you suffering a heart attack, or someone else running by and grabbing the ice cream before you could. So the choice is ours to control, but the outcome, I suppose, isn't. Maybe that's the distinction that I'm drawing.
Right. And that's the Chrysippean notion of co-fating, right? So as Tony explained so well, the horme, the impulse that results from assenting to the impression that the ice cream is attractive, desirable, tasty looking, then initiates the bodily movement. But as you pointed out correctly, Tanner, the movements of the body take place in a causal nexus in the world. And so if your body is physically constrained, then although you might be assenting to the impression and attempting to reach for the ice cream and eat it, there are things that can intervene and block the result being getting the ice cream in your hand and getting it to your mouth to eat. And so that's why you need both, right? Because if you don't have the assent that the ice cream is to be eaten, right? That's the lecton, that's the sayable, right? The ice cream is to be eaten. You then assent to that proposition. That's up to you. But you need both that and a lack of external physical constraint on your body so that your arm goes to the ice cream and you get it and then you can eat it, right? You need both of those things. So both that internal event, if we want to call assent an internal event, and the external motion of the body are the two, approximate causes, right? The two events that both need to occur in order for the final event to be your eating of the ice cream. Is that accurate, Tony?
Yes, I want to just pick up on, I agree, Bill. But Tanner, you said something about, if I can remember how you phrased it, you said something about fate making something happen. Fate is not an agent. Fate is, I mean, to talk about fate in a collective way, fate for the Stoics is the whole nexus of all possible causes that, you know, from the very beginning of our present cosmos, we can collectively say that this network of causes that Bill described, the causal nexus. But we shouldn't talk about fate as an agent. Fate is not there are causes, and there are causes for the impression that I have of the ice cream. It's had nothing to do with me. That's just the state of the world outside me. And that's sometimes called the antecedent cause in Stoic parlance. And there's the influence or possible influence of that event on me. And then I become, in turn, a cause. So I'm part of the causal nexus. But the fate is not something independent of me. Even in the case of an inanimate object like a stone, there's something about the stone itself which will cause its action. Say, if the wind moves the stone, but there's something about the stone itself which is part of the effect that will have. So we can think of all things in the world as having sort of internal and external or structural principles. Human beings are very complicated because we have desires, we have thoughts, and so the way we react to the world is very complicated. And the choice that you make in Stoicism is going to be a function of your whole character, your dispositions. And so fate could not operate in any part of the world. It can't operate without some contribution from the individual things. And in the case of human beings, that's especially complex.
So that's interesting, because something that it's not interesting because I've said it in the past, but it is interesting, and I've said something in the past that connects the two things, is the idea that in the web of causality, human beings and the, let's just assume human beings are the only things in the universe capable of making choices the way that we do. But we are the things in the cosmos that, when the threads of that web come together, it is up to us to make choices, in that if we don't make choices, fate cannot continue. Fate happens through us rather than to us. So it's almost as if we are little decision-making machines that are part and parcel of allowing fate to, I don't like to use the word unfurl, but I guess that's what I'm going to say. Is that somewhat on the money?
Well, again, I slightly worry about the way you're treating, it seems again you're treating fate almost as a thing. Fate is a name for this network of causality, and we are, like everything else in the world, even including God, I think, we are inclusive in this causal network. So yes, if we think about God for a moment, what the Stoics call Zeus, we are to suppose that at the beginning of each world cycle, during the so-called conflagration, when nothing is happening, there is no cosmos during the conflagration, but there is this being, Zeus, who is said to, you know, plan out the world. And then, as Seneca puts it, he makes a decision once, and then everything follows from that, including God's own role in the network of causes. And so this. So there is a plan. There's a blueprint, we could say, and we are part of that blueprint. But because we're very complicated beings, the way the world acts, the way fate, if you want to put it in that way, the way fate develops, require it, as Bill put it, it's co-fate. We're co-fated with the next external network of causes will have different kinds of effects on different people depending on their characters. So some people will refrain from taking the ice cream for all kinds of reasons. I mean, they're on a diet or they don't like ice cream or what it may be. So there's no way in which we can just say the ice cream determined those people's choices or didn't determine them, because how those people respond to the ice cream depends on them, put it that way. And so fate couldn't possibly operate at all without people having making their own minds up about things.
William, do you want to add to that before I reply?
Yeah, I mean, I would just maybe offer this this gloss on Tony's account, which is that I think it's fair to say that, you know, identifying nature with fate is very insightful. I mean, it's illustrative, as Tony was explaining, because when a human being assents to an impression and that triggers the impulse to attempt an action with one's body, that is as much a natural event as a rock falling off a cliff face. I mean, that's exactly, you know, Tony's point, I take it, that human beings are embedded in nature just as rocks and streams and mountains and the wind is. And all of these things operate in this natural scheme, and all of them are interconnected causally and influence each other because all of them are bodies, and only bodies can act causally on other bodies. And so human beings are just as bodily as stones and trees and fish are. So our natural environment provides the context in which we move about in the world. And because of our psychology, as Tony said, because of our rationality, because of how our desires are interwoven with judgments that we make, cognitive judgments that we make, a sense that we make to propositions, and how that works with our psychology and agency. You know, there's a more complex story to tell when the wind is blowing against us than when the wind is blowing against the branch of a tree. But both events are equally fated because they're taking place in a, you know, thoroughly natural web of causes and effects based on the natures of each thing, right? Other animals, non-human animals, have desires. And so their psychology is more complex than that of rocks. And plants have their own internal impulses of phototropism, right? Plants turn to the sun, flowers turn to the sun, and they take in water and, you know, nutrients from the soil. And so the way they behave in their environment is more complex than that of mere minerals. And we're more complex than animals, but all of them are in this causal nexus. So all of them behave in a fated way. It's just that we are special on the Stoic view because we have this spark of Zeus in us. This is our logos, which in other writing, Tony has described as, if I remember correctly, you know, a particularly dense gathering of logos, right? We've got a lot of logos in us, and the logos that's dispersed throughout the rest of the universe is not as densely located. And because of that, we have this complex psychology, but we are participating in this volitional contribution to events in a way like the gods, like Zeus does, only we have more limited powers, and our bodies are different than Zeus's, because Zeus's body extends throughout all of nature, right? Zeus's body isn't limited in space. It is all of space.
I'd like to just, I totally agree with all that you've said there, Bill, not to wish to say that, you know, we would agree about everything always, but I think what you said about nature is very important. Let me just try to put it in different context. I think rather than talking about free will in the Stoic context, it would be better to talk about agency and responsibility. As regards nature, I think the notion of ourselves as parts of nature, we are parts of nature in a very strong sense. I mean, we're We're biological beings. In that sense, we're natural. But we're also physically coordinated to the world. I mean, we cannot do anything at all without being impacted by the forces of the external world. Understanding that is liberating for the Stoics. I think people perhaps who worry about free will, they have both a kind of Cartesian notion of the world, the self, as a kind of totally kind of detached kind of mind, but also a sort of rather romantic but vulnerable sense of their own special individuality. Now, Stoics have a strong sense of their own individuality, but they recognize, as Bill has put it, that they're parts of nature. And I think what the Stoics really did for Greek philosophy, which wasn't really there even with Aristotle, did some of the work, but nobody before the Stoics had really shown what it really means to be a human agent. The notion of the mind has a capacity which is called assent. Assent is just the Latin translation of a very obscure Greek word, synkatathesis. But really, the notion we call assent, it involves both an intellectual component, sort of understanding the situation you're placed in the world, and then whether you come to agree with that situation or not. So you're saying yes or no to it. That's liberating. That's what the Stoics produced. Nobody before the Stoics had spoken that way. And they then really put on the map, I think, the whole notion of human beings as autonomous agents. Now, you might say, well, that seems very strange because they have a notion of fate. But as we were saying before, this notion of autonomy and ascent is part of the web of fate. So again, I mean, the Stoics had this vivid example of co-fatedness. They said, well, the father of Oedipus, the Greek mythological figure, he was fated to slay his father and marry his mother. So it's fated in that sense. That cannot not happen. But it can't happen unless Laius chooses to act in a certain way. It's co-fated in that sense. And so we should, again, think of all human actions as involving this internal decision process, which is part of the network of fate. Fate doesn't make people do things. Fate is the way things come out, but that involves agency.
This is something that I run into a lot just in any of the reading or understanding I try to do of Stoicism in the 3 or so years that I've been attempting to live as a good Stoic and to study and learn about it. They being the Stoics, the ancient Stoics, have such nuanced definitions and understandings, which I'm calling nuanced, but are perhaps in reality just perhaps the original or older versions of understanding of these things. You say that free will and agency are not the same thing. I think that in contemporary times, people would conflate those two things. I certainly do. If you have agency, then you have free will. So I suppose the next question I'd like to ask is, how would you describe the difference between agency and free will? What makes those two things not the same?
I'd have to ask you again to clarify exactly then when you say you think agency means, you say it means free will?
I think in a contemporary sense, when someone says, oh, I have agency, I think the way that is interpreted is I can do what I would like to do. And I think when they interpret the term free will, they would define it as being the same thing. I can do what I would like to do. But you're suggesting that there is a difference between those two things, and I'm just interested in what that difference is.
Well, okay. Maybe I was presuming a view which I think has been very well contested by Michael Frader in his book on free will. Let me ask you this. I mean, so do you suppose that at any moment, at this very moment, it's open to you either to do or not to do something? I mean, the idea that to be free to do something entails the fact that you could have acted otherwise at the same moment. And that's, I think, do you think that's the case, Tanner? You wouldn't have free will unless you could have done something else at the same time.
I think that is what I think, yes. And I think it's what many other people would think as well, yes.
But if that were the case, then this means that, say, the virtuous person could at this moment also plunder a bus or...
Oh, that's so good. That's so good, Tony.
Right.
I'm upset at how obvious and good that is. Oh, can you finish your... William, talk about that, because that's so brilliant.
Yeah. So we're not inclined. We really need to clarify what we mean by freedom here. This is why Tony's talking about agency in terms of liberation is vital, right? Because if you think about somebody like Epictetus, and nobody knows as much about Epictetus as Tony does, of course, but Epictetus would distinguish between freedom and will. So, Tanner, when you talk about free will, we can actually kind of detach those two as concepts for Epictetus, because his concept of freedom means freedom from anxiety, freedom from passion, freedom from lust, all of these things which interfere with your ability to desire the things that are going to contribute to your human flourishing or happiness, right? And if he's shackled in a dungeon somewhere, his master, the chains on him, don't interfere with his freedom to exercise his judgments in a rational way, in agreement with nature, in all the different senses of living in agreement with nature that Epictetus explains, right? And so he has complete freedom when he's sitting in the dungeon all shackled up. Now, he's not free to chew through these steel bonds that are constraining his body, but that's not what real freedom is for Epictetus, right? And this is going to strike many moderns as very counterintuitive. He's not free to break out of his bonds and leave the dungeon and live whatever life he wants to live, living whatever life he wants to live, as if he would choose to live a life contrary to nature. And this is Tony's point, right? The virtuous agent is going to make the right choice in any circumstance, and is, from our perspective, very, very predictable then, right? That is, if we had the same wisdom, if we had the same knowledge of what's good and bad and right and wrong, we would be able to predict the behavior of another virtuous agent or person with 100% confidence, right? If we were a sage, we would know just how other sages would act, right? But it's because we lack virtue that sometimes we make the bad decision. And for Epictetus and the Stoics, that's going to be the result of making false judgments about what's good, what's bad, and what's indifferent. And that's what leads to our mistakes. So, Tony, I mean, I don't know, Tanner, if you'll allow me this, but one thing I would want to ask Tony about is his view of the relationship in Epictetus between what's up to us and the prohairesis, and then how sunkatathesis and assent figure into that scheme, because the prohairesis is often translated will or volition, as Tony has translated sometimes in the past.
Just before you answer that question, Tony, I want to make it clear that a lot of the people who listen to this podcast are in the beginning stages of exploring Stoicism. So a word like prohairesis, we might need to define that to make sure that we're not speaking over anyone who's watching.
Very good. Thank you. I mean, just a little bit of a historical context here. I mean, if we do ask, when does free will, in the sense I think you started from, Tanner, when does that notion really come into a big way in ancient thought? I think it's actually with Christianity. I think it's Christianity where, and you find this in the Christian theologian Origen, that free will is required somehow in order to commit yourself to the Christian way. And if you don't make that commitment somehow, then the will, your will is at fault, and you are going to be have a bad life because of the notion of having this will, which is recalcitrant and not going along with the true way. That I think is when with earlier Christianity, I think that's when free will really becomes a big deal. Whereas I think what we've been saying, and I go back to Bill's point about the Epictetus sort of in his imaginary in his prison cell. Yes, he's free from all kinds of impassions and unhappiness that the non-Stoic would experience, because the non-Stoic would be saying, oh, woe is me, why is this horrible thing happening to me, and I don't deserve it. He's free from all that. But we shouldn't think his freedom is only freedom from. I think it's also freedom to. he's free to do all kinds of things while he's in the prison, subject to the constraints of nature. I mean, if he's locked up, he's not free to leave, but nor would anybody be. I don't think we should try to think of Stoics in their interests in perfecting their dispositions as sort of somehow a special class of people. They're subject to the same kind of constraints or freedoms in the ordinary sense as everybody else. It's just that they have this special dimension of being able to think of their lives in a much broader way. They're constrained by nature, but they also understand nature. They understand what's humanly possible. And so when they act, and if you want to say they act through free will, it's through an understanding that what they can do is up to them, and they don't make choices of things that are not up to them, like you know, thinking they can fly when they can't.
Okay, so then can we move on to the next question, which I don't even think we'll have enough time for the third one. But before we do that, can I just verify that what I'm getting out of this is that free will, in the way that we think about it today, probably needs some adjusting, but also that in some way, not only does it exist in Stoicism, but it seems as though it is a necessary consequence of fate, not as a single entity or being, but as a phenomenon, that it is part of fate. It's not removable.
Right.
Oh, that's great. I love that. I have free will. I feel so good now. Thank you, Tony. This episode is made possible in part by Factor Meals, and I know that I've raved about this company and service in the past, but forgive me because I'm going to do it again because it is absolutely awesome. Chef-quality meals, each shaped around whatever nutrition methodology you prefer, paleo, vegetarian, vegan, low-carb, keto, whatever floats your boat, delivered to your door every week to help keep you eating the way you want to eat, even on and especially on days where maybe you don't have time to make the choices you want to make. And all of this is customizable to your schedule and lifestyle. At the very least, you need to learn more about it and decide whether or not to give it a try yourself. Head to factormeals.com/practical50, that's practical50, and use the code practical50 to get 50% off of your first box plus 20% off of your next box. That's practical50 at factormeals.com/practical50 to get 50% off of your first box plus 20% off of your next box while your subscription is active. I have used a lot of commerce platforms in the past. By far, the most robust is Shopify. No matter how complex your business needs and no matter how large your business grows, Shopify can handle it. And they do handle it for brands like Rothy's, Ruggable, Allbirds, Knox, Magnolia, Brooklinen, Glossier, and Cotton, to name a few. You may already use another e-commerce platform and you may be super unhappy with it, but you've already put a lot of work into it and migrating to Shopify could seem impossible. But I'm here to tell you that it is quite easy. When I migrated to Shopify back in 2022, their apps and tools meant I just had to make a few clicks and everything was ported over as if by magic. Shopify also lets you design your storefront however you like, which from personal experience I know isn't the case for many other commerce platforms out there. All these features and all this control can result in more sales more often. So stop leaving sales on the table. Switch your business to Shopify today and discover why millions trust Shopify as their all-in-one commerce platform to build, grow, and run their businesses. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial at shopify.com/practical, all lowercase. That's 1 month for just $1 at shopify.com/practical. shopify.com/practical. Next question is, and again, I write these down because I want to make sure that I deliver them well. And this is going to take you back about two decades, Tony. So I hope you remember the paper or the talk. In 2002, you wrote a paper entitled Zeno's Epistemology and Plato's Theaetetus, if I'm pronouncing that correctly. In it, you spoke about the cataleptic, which is at the root of Stoic ideas of identifying what is logical and reasonable to believe, to viewing the world as it truly is. In that paper, which I think you actually delivered as a talk in Zeno's hometown of Citium, you mention how Zeno's adoption of the cataleptic as Stoicism's criterion of truth was incredibly controversial. So first, what is the cataleptic? What does it mean to be the criterion of truth? And why was this so controversial at the time?
Thank you very much, Tanner. Yes, I think it's one of their great contributions to the history of philosophy, although it will always remain, I think, controversial. So cataleptic, what it means for an impression to be cataleptic is that this visual experience, this auditory experience you're having, or let's say, you know, while we're having this a conversation now, we're seeing and hearing one another, that what we are hearing and seeing, it is not a fantasy. It's not an imagination. That's the way the world is. And when you have a cataleptic impression, the Stoics want to say the impression is not only true. The world really is the way you're seeing it or hearing it or smelling it. But it couldn't be otherwise. That the impression, you couldn't have the kind of vivid impression that you are having, you know, of this wonderful strawberry ice cream, unless there were out there a strawberry ice cream just of the kind that you're seeing. So the impressions that are cataleptic not only capture the world as it is, but we couldn't be having those kind of experiences if the world were not that way. So we can see now why they might say, well, if this is the case, if we do have these kind of impressions, then they are a criterion of truth because we can rely on them. They are so strong and solid that we can't be mistaken. Now, that's where the controversy arose, because the people who were called the skeptics, academic skeptics, said, well, that's all very well, but surely it is possible that this impression you have, however strong and vivid it seems, is it not impossible that an equally looking or equally sounding impression could exist, which actually was, you know, created by an evil demon? It wasn't the way the world is. How can we have the criterion of, you know, do we need another criterion to validate the cataleptic impression? And so the Stoics then wanted to try to found their epistemology on this view. And I think to make it plausible, we have to assume that they think that most of our impressions in everyday life are cataleptic. Otherwise, how could we get around in the world? But of course, we are capable of being deceived. I think the poster has just arrived and put a letter under the door. But you know, I was wrong. It was the wind blowing something. So the infallibility of the cataleptic impression was a great point of controversy.
So in other words, what that makes me think of is the example of the wax apple, mm-hmm. where I can't remember who it is, but they're offered I'm doing this not because you don't know what I'm talking about, Tony, but because people listening might not know. Someone offers a Stoic an apple made of wax. The Stoic assents to the impression that it is actually an apple and bites into it. And I think the person who offers it to him makes some comment about, haha, see, you're not so smart. That is interesting because it suggests this kind of, is that the start of this infinite reductionism that we see so frequently in philosophy following the classical period, where we always want to have a cause of a cause of a cause?
Yeah, I mean, Chrysippus, the great Stoic logician, although he's not a household name, he ought to be, because he was as great a philosopher as any that came out of antiquity. Chrysippus exploited what's known as the Sorites paradox. So Sorites means a heap. So think of a heap of grains of sand, and there's a whole pile of them there. You say, well, that's a lot. And you start counting them and then say, well, you know, how many make a heap? Is it 100? Yeah, maybe. Well, 101 or 99. And you go on like that. And then at a certain point, you got down to, say, 3. Are 3 many? Well, they're more than 1. Okay, what about 2? Well, still more than 1. But now, what about 1? So at some point, the chain argument, as a chain argument, gets to a point where you can't make any decision without it seeming to go one way or the other. And Chrysippus advised people when they were having debates about this. He said, look, you do know when you're getting near the point at which, it becomes more controversial, just stop answering the question at that point. So you can't answer the question how many grains make a heap. You can only come up with conjectures and guesses and say stop at a certain point. So it's really a very good way of pointing out certain things that are, you know, fuzzy in logic, and that's just the way the world is.
I love the idea that Chrysippus is the first one to have to deal with the infinite why question that we get from kids. Why? William, did you want to add anything to that?
No, I just to reiterate what Tony said, that this is one example of a number, I think, of the ancient skeptics really challenging the Stoics to strengthen their system, to work out these sorts of, to respond to these sorts of really tough logical challenges in their epistemology. But also, I mean, I think if it weren't for the skeptics, it's not clear that the Stoics would have made the advances they did in logic, in sentential logic, propositional logic, and with regard to the ethics as well. So this is just another example in the history of philosophy that sometimes the philosopher is only as good as his best critics are, and challenging him to think harder and develop new concepts which address serious critical challenges. And so the Stoics are really kind of indebted to the skeptics in this respect. And also with regard to the system building, and this gets back to Tony's comment at the very beginning. As he said, I mean, decades ago, being drawn to a systematic philosophy, it just was so out of vogue. Nobody did this. And this is in the wake of Wittgenstein, right? Where analytic philosophy was about tackling very small, specific, concrete problems one at a time and knocking down the worst alternatives and propping up the better ones. But there was no allure. There was no respect for tackling a really kind of holistic, systematic worldview that the Stoics offered. Because there've always been, well, not always, but there've often been good skeptics out there, but there haven't been that many people who are system builders like the Stoics were, who take up that gauntlet thrown before them and want to try to build a holistic worldview as the Stoics did.
Yeah, I mean, just picking up for a moment in case people are interested, Bill, people haven't, I think, been reading in recent years the work of Alfred North Whitehead. Whitehead was a great mathematician who debated the foundations of arithmetic with Bertrand Russell. But he also, in his later years, got very interested in something that's been called process theology.
Yes.
And process theology, which I only sort of dabbled in, but I've been reading a bit of Whitehead, especially if you think of Stoicism in terms of what Bill was talking about, the notion of nature, this kind of wet natural environment that we live in which everything is interconnected. Whitehead was very interested in the sort of the vitalist notions of nature, and in terms of modern interests in ecology and the vital nature of and whether, you know, the whole question of how did life start? What is life primitive, or did it evolve? On all these questions, I think, which are quite a number of my Stoic friends have got interested in, Stoicism is very, very good to think with here. I'm thinking particularly of a concept they developed called taking the word seminal, spermatic, meaning to do with the, literally the sexual male fluid. They took this notion into what they call the spermatic logos, the seminal reason, which is what they thought is how God creates the world. God somehow impregnates the world, it's a kind of mythological sense, with his seed from which everything flourishes and grows. And so the Stoic model of the universe, really, not the universe in sort of outer space, but at least the planetary world, the world of Earth, is a living world. As a living world, and I think again we're becoming aware of how important it is for us to think of our natural environment as something we are connected with, not something we exploit, but something that belongs to us and that we belong to, and that's very Stoic in modern sense.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
This is Peter.
And this is Tom.
We want to tell you guys a little bit about our podcast. Tom and I met in college, became best friends, and then teachers almost 20 years ago. Sometimes school just does not allow us to elaborate on the topics that we find interesting, like the real shark attacks that inspired the movie Jaws, or the real historical context to Indiana Jones artifacts. Where does cereal come from? Or are zombies real? Does Ben Franklin really deserve to be on a $100 bill? On our podcast, just like in our class, there are no stupid questions.
Just two friends having lighthearted conversation about history, pop culture, and the context of current events.
Listen to History Teachers Talking Podcast from Evergreen Network, anywhere you get your podcasts.
I think this question, as a result of it being off the cuff, is going to be somewhat controversial, but I hope that you will both hear me out to understand why I'm asking it. Do virtue ethics still exist outside of a religious context? And the reason I ask that is the Stoics understood virtue to be, and please correct me if I've been getting this wrong for years, the knowledge of how to live excellently, of arete. Is that the idea of virtue in any context outside of classical philosophy? Because if it's not, then could virtue ethics still be said to exist in contemporary or modern philosophies?
Oh, very much so. Virtue ethics is very much a going concern these days. There are many philosophers. This has become very popular. And actually, including applied to environmental ethics, as Tony was just mentioning. There's a movement, there are philosophers working in environmental virtue ethics. I suppose I'm one of them. I've written a couple pieces inspired by that approach.
Well, do those stand alone as forms of virtue ethics, or are they based off of Stoic virtue ethics?
Well, they're indebted both to the Stoic ethical approach and account of virtues. But also, prior to the Stoics, of course, they borrow. There are many people inspired by Aristotle. I mean, Martha Nussbaum has spent a lot of time and effort developing, writing about a more Aristotelian-based conception of virtues applied to contemporary philosophical issues. That's what's so rich about the field of virtue ethics. You've got the more Aristotelian leaning virtue ethicists. You've got the more Stoic leaning virtue ethicists. I saw a recent work reviewed about virtue ethics that challenged a common view that is held by the Stoics and defenders of the Stoics that virtues are always interentailing. To have one virtue means to have them all. This is the unity of the virtues thesis. For the Stoics, if you're wise, then you're necessarily also courageous, just, generous, pious, and so on. This review was of a recent work that challenged that and said, no, this does not comport with our experience in life. We know many people who have some virtues but clearly lack others. And so there's been a fundamental challenge to that. And this is not a recent challenge. This has gone on for quite a while, but it's received maybe more traction lately to challenge this unity of the virtues position. But as you were asking, Tanner, I mean, sure, you can make a kind of theologically grounded form of virtue ethics, which includes Christian virtues of faith, hope, and charity. And agape, right? Christian love. Or you can have a more secular kind of virtue ethics. These are also in the mix these days.
Yeah, that's very good. I think, I mean, it wasn't just the Stoics who developed the unity of the virtues. In fact, it's a Platonic, Socratic, probably Socratic, if we can go back to Socrates. It's certainly Platonic and also challenged in Plato. I mean, in one of Plato's dialogues, the sophist Protagoras challenges this view, especially on the view that surely somebody could be courageous, but they could also, you know, have a rather loose hand when it comes to shoplifting. But they could, you know, they could be the person who dives into the lake to save the child and maybe lose their life in the process. So I think, yes, William's right, of course, that high moral qualities in general. But the thing I think with Stoicism and virtue ethics and perhaps in ancient ethics, well, perhaps not the Epicureans quite the same way, but ancient ethics in general is perfectionist. And so the reason why they say the virtues are inter-entailing is because, well, to miss out on one would be in some sense to be imperfect. And it's also the idea somehow that if you're looking at the virtues as having some kind of harmonious structure, then if to miss out on one, to have that kind of disequilibrium would make you feel short. But in general, I think you're absolutely right. Julia Annis has written a whole book following Aristotle on virtue ethics. I'm not up with that bibliography terribly much, but I think it's very popular. How would you, I could ask William, how would you define virtue ethics? I mean, to distinguish it from some other type of ethics, what would you say?
Well, I mean, in terms of categorizing approaches to ethics, traditionally, when I was learning this as an undergrad in a graduate school, the fundamental distinction was between the deontological approach, which follows Kant, and and the utilitarian consequentialist approach, and so virtue ethics at the time was kind of resuscitated or resurrected from the ancients as a third option, which doesn't focus on evaluating the rightness or wrongness of an action, but conceives of ethics as the discipline which studies character as the solution to the problem of how to live, right? So it shifts the question from how to act. Okay, well, if you're a deontologist like a Kantian, then you bring in the categorical imperative and you've got a couple different formulations, and then you formulate the maxim of the rule and then you see if you can will it. Okay, fine. Whereas the consequentialist says, well, how am I to act in this situation? Well, if I were to do this, these would be the likely consequences. If I fail to do this, these would be the likely consequences, which are going to have more positive effects as consequences, always focused on the action and its consequences, whether the action fits or passes the test, right? Whereas the eudaimonist approach, the virtue ethics approach, thinks of human lives as things which are constructed in such a way that you're aiming for a goal, right? The whole notion of telos, right? What is your purpose? What kind of a life? What is the shape of the life that you're trying to achieve? Well, if you want to have a good life, then you need to have a certain set of dispositions that you develop, a certain kind of character, which allows you to respond in different circumstances in the sort of way that's going to promote that good life that you are trying to achieve. So in terms of categorization, that would be the third option. And it does invite a number of different approaches to these thorny ethical problems in applied ethics that many have wrestled with, either from a deontological or a consequentialist approach. And it opened a lot of interesting avenues. A lot of good stuff has been written.
What you said earlier about it being resurrected as a third option, I think, and this is why I have to script my questions when I have people like William and Tony. Tony's never going to come back. He thinks I'm an idiot now. But the question is, the thing I was getting at is, when I look at what I view as being the, am I going to call it the apex of classical philosophies? They all led to Epicureanism, skepticism, and Stoicism. And then I guess the classical period of philosophy ends. And I feel like I can see Epicureanism reflected somewhere in nihilistic hedonism. From a modern standpoint, I can see skepticism reflected in moral and ethical relativism. But I don't see virtue ethics in anything in the modern philosophical time period outside of religion. And it seems that I'm wrong on that. So was there a, how do I want to ask this? Was there a virtue ethics philosophy that was created in the modern era or no?
Well, I think Bill put it very well when he said that people, you know, the two great options, the Kantian idealist notion and intuitive notion of the good, and the utilitarian consequentialist notion, those prevailed throughout the, you know, 19th, 20th century. And both of them have very, you know, large weaknesses, you know, which we haven't time to go into, even though each of them may, you know, capture some great moral truths as well. And virtue ethics, I think, focusing on neither on the action themselves nor on the reasons, the dispositions, but on the character of the agent. And so the Stoics called it the wise man. Aristotle called him the phronimos. You say, well, how should I act? Well, this is how an exemplary agent, I mean, an ideal agent would act in these circumstances. A very good letter by the Roman Stoic Seneca on this question. I mean, he says, here was this person. He did all these great things, but when it came, a bit like my example of the courageous person who then is shoplifting, he says, but there was this other person, and he, you know, and then he gives all these different contexts. You know, he was good in this respect, good in that, in other, and it's an ideal. It's an ideal exemplary example, because Christianity had it with the notion of imitation of Christ, that the Christ is the model. And the Stoics had this idea of the wise person or becoming like God. I mean, again, it was all, I think, you know, to understand Stoicism, it's a perfectionist philosophy. Nobody gets there. Nobody fully gets there. But it's what's great about it, I think, is the idea that there isn't an end to it. You're always can always improve. So the wise man or wise woman hasn't yet perhaps ever been achieved. But that doesn't mean that there isn't a way, you know, a road to go. I think that's also part of why putting the emphasis, moral ethical emphasis on character and intention. Well, not I wouldn't let's say that goes perhaps into the Kantian route too much. But in any case, the other points that William made, I think, about why. So I think virtue ethics is actually very much alive. We may not be able to point to a single very famous name, but you know, Martha Nussbaum and Julia Annis are pretty big people to follow.
Well, in our contemporary Stoic context too, Larry Becker. I mean, his work on his new Stoicism work. It's a very meticulous study of practical agency, and so it's very much inspired and very secular too, Tanner. So it's a very, you know, kind of secular approach to practical agency inspired by Stoic concepts. And one quick comment I want to make about study of Kant is. The greater attention that virtue ethics has received in the last 20 years. And of course we have to thank Tony for this, right? Because were it not for Tony Long, you know, I would not have had the career that I did, right? I mean, there's so many scholars who've studied Stoicism because Tony was such a trailblazer, such a pioneer in doing this work. So, it's important to make that point. But in an understanding Kant, notice that Kant has a doctrine of virtues. But people who studied Kant for years ignored that. And they approached him in this idealist way that as Tony described it. They approached it as a deontology, right? Deontology is a theory of virtue. And so you've had this kind of interesting cross-fertilization with people taking virtue ethics seriously and character study seriously and looking at Kant through different lenses, not thinking just in terms of the categorical imperative and rule following and that sort of thing, but looking at Kant's doctrine of virtues. Maybe we could think of Kant as a kind of virtue ethicist. At least many aspects of his work could be better understood that way. Conversely, we have this recent work on Stoicism as the first deontology. Right, this guy Jack Vizinjic has this very interesting book on rules in Stoicism and whether and you know sort of unpacking how the Stoics used rules in their practical reasoning, so that you have this cross-fertilization with deontology and virtue ethics, which wouldn't have happened if we hadn't have had this renaissance of virtue ethics and Stoicism, which we're indebted to Tony for really starting.
I just add one very quick word. I mean, you're absolutely right to mention Larry Becker, whom I was privileged to know, and we knew each other and we corresponded, and I greatly liked him and very sorry that he's no longer with us. The one thing that I would demur about Becker's stoicism, he was so anxious to make it sort of not theological that I think he misrepresented the theology. God, of course, is a horribly difficult notion ever to talk about. But if we think, as William was talking about nature, if we think of stoicism as naturalistic theology, not God up in heaven and giving rules and things, but simply the vitalist principle of the universe, which he is for stoicism, then I think we stoicism shouldn't dispense with that notion of God. I think if it does, it loses something. It shouldn't be just virtue ethics. There is this, well, almost you call it transcendental notion of fitting in with nature. That life in accordance with nature, it does involve, it's not a supernatural principle, it's a kind of hypernatural principle, you could put it that way.
But would you describe it as transcendental, Tony, or immanent, right? It's a kind of immanence, right? Isn't this?
Yes, certainly.
The panentheism, you've done, a wonderful job of illustrating Epictetus's panentheism, right? So it's God in nature, not God above nature, or God as nature. And that's the Whitehead as well. The other just very quickly, the thing I wanted to comment about, just to add about what you said about Whitehead earlier, was this notion, this emphasis on process. Surely we have to thank Heraclitus for this, right? And so Heraclitus is a forebear of this Stoic cosmology, informing Stoic cosmology, which we see also in the process emphasis that Whitehead then inherits and articulates in such an interesting way.
And here is where the public-facing part of this discussion ends, because when I asked Tony, which you don't hear, but when I asked Tony if he could spend some more time with me, which he spends about another 20 minutes with me, which is, I feel very privileged that he was up for that and interested at all in doing it. But the additional minutes contain questions and answers from myself, but also from patrons. And so I wanted to make sure that patrons felt that they were extra taken care of in a situation where I get a very extraordinary guest like A.A. Long on. It certainly doesn't happen every day. And so if you are a patron of this show, you can get access to some additional conversation with A.A. Long if you just check the Patreon feed. Also, if you're interested in the video version of this discussion, patrons get that as well. So it pays to be a patron. It's not just a nice way to support me. It's a nice way to get rid of ads and to get little extras like this one, for instance. If you're not already a patron, you can go to stoicismpod.com/members and become one today for just $5 a month. There's also the option to pay yearly if that's more convenient for you. I want to thank you for listening. I hope you've enjoyed this episode. I truly enjoyed being able to speak to someone of the stature of A.A. Long and feel very privileged that he accepted an invitation to return to the show in the future more than one time to continue to have occasional conversations like this one. So thanks again for listening. I hope you enjoyed it. And until next time, take care.